Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, my goodness, I'm so delighted that you're joining me. Of course, you know I say that every evening, but I really mean it, because we have so many different talented people in the world, and one of my guests is one of those talented people. We're going to be discussing art. My guest is Danny Gregory, and this man has put together one of the most delightful publications I have seen relative to developing your creative side. It's How to Draw Without Talent. Now, if you are like so many people, you say, I can't even draw a straight line. I'm terrible. Just don't even go there. I don't want to do it. I come up awful. I flunked art class. Well, I think by the time we're finished talking, you may have a different attitude. And believe me, if you have children that like to doodle or draw, please don't make fun of what they do. Encourage them to do their drawings, because you never know how it's going to evolve. Danny Gregory, I want to welcome you to the show.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here, Donna.
I'll have to tell you, Danny, one of the first things that won my heart was the partially drawn Scottish Terrier that you have on the back cover of your book. I'm a Scottish Terrier. What do I want to say? A holic? I love them. I just think they're marvelous. And whoever did that drawing, if you did that, whoever did it, you captured the soul of a Scotty that obviously was in your environment.
Well, thank you very much. I love Scotties, too, and I love to draw all kinds of dogs. In fact, I went through a period a little while ago where I drew a dog, a different dog, every single day for, I think it was 130 days.
Oh, my different heavens.
Different breeds in different styles, dogs doing different things. They're just so much fun to draw, and, you know, it's a great challenge as well as great fun.
Oh, yes. You have a drawing in here of what I think is a little pug. Is that is on page 11, those great big eyes, its little ears are down, its tiny, tiny tail is up, and it looks like a puppy.
It is. That's a pug puppy, and my wife loves pugs. I drew that for her, and they always have the funny eyes that go off in different directions. As she says, one eye on the bread, one eye on the butter.
Danny, you have obviously a very good sense of humor about life, and the book itself is really a feast of color. It is just every page, when you turn it, is a different color. It has got all kinds of artwork in it, and something I think that so often we forget is that when you walk into a museum and you're looking at art, you will see styles like I have seen, some of them were drawn by Picasso, that you'd say, I swear that was done by a kindergartner, not by some master artist, but somebody that just really was just beginning to learn how to draw. These are things that most of us don't really pay much attention to, do we? It's art is an expression that's unlimited.
Absolutely. Look, you and I and everybody who is listening was once an artist, right? When we were 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, you could give us a box of crayons and some sheets of paper, and we would sit happily expressing ourselves, inventing new things, playing and creating without worry at all. It was terrific fun, and we didn't have to worry about it being our profession. We didn't have to worry about going to school or taking courses. We didn't have any concerns at all. We were just having fun. And one of my goals is to get people to remember that and to realize you can do it the same now. You can have the same fun, and we just have to get out of our own way, and we just have to stop telling ourselves, well, I'm not good enough, well, I don't know how to do it. And that's why I wrote a book called How to Draw Without Talent, because I think we have this idea that we need to have talent, that we need to have this God-given ability that some of us have and some of us don't have. I may have it. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. We can still have fun just like we did when we were little kids.
And the expression, I mean, do you think of Andy Warhol? He did something just about a can of tomato soup, for heaven's sakes, and everybody goes gaga over it. Well, it was just what already had been out in the public. Why go gaga? We need to remember that sometimes just doing it is really, I think it's therapeutic myself. I think it's marvelous to work with colors, and I've seen people that have been sort of depressed, and when they start doing their paintings, it's like all of that stuff goes away. They really, just like you said, they're having fun with it. Now, you start your book off right away with the four drawings and the first hand drawing. How many parents have a piece of plaster clay that their child has somewhere in class put their hand into it, and they treasure that piece of stuff that's anything but artistically glamorous, and it is that first-hand impression, and that's what you have here is the first-hand drawing. It's right at the beginning. Why is that so important to do, Danny?
Because what I want you to do is to surprise yourself. Right now, you might think, I just can't draw. I can't draw anything. I can't draw a straight line. So I say, okay, let's start by drawing and seeing where you're at. Maybe in fact, you can't draw anything, but let's see. Get a piece of paper, and let's draw five or six little things. Let's draw a mug, a car, a tree, a building, a person, and your hand. So sit down, look at your hand, and draw it. Now, take that piece of paper and put it away. Don't worry about whether it was good or not good, because the fact is, if it wasn't good, well, then you have a lot of progress to make, and you can come back and see how far you've gotten. And if it was good, if you surprised yourself, well, that's encouraging, and you can keep going. So this is just a benchmark, a starting place to say, let's do a few drawings, and then we're going to get into the book, and we're going to learn some stuff, and we're going to play some games, and we're going to try some things. And in fact, at the very back of the book, I ask you to do the same thing again. So I say, all right, let's go to the very last couple of pages, page 120, and I'm going to ask you to do the same thing after you've learned a bunch of concepts, after you've done a few exercises, and let's see what difference it made. And I bet you it will make a huge difference, even if you don't have any talent.
You have your own story relative to art. What is it that you do professionally that encouraged you to even get into drawing? I mean, the diversification in style that's here in your book is marvelous.
Well, thanks very much. But the fact is, I didn't go to art school. I never took any classes. And I didn't start drawing until I was in my late 30s. So I really hadn't drawn since I was a little kid, and I started drawing then. And I've been drawing now for a couple of decades since. I'm getting ancient. But I taught myself how to draw by drawing, and that's what changed my life. It completely freed me up. It gave me so much fun. And I discovered that drawing is a wonderful form of meditation. It is a form of self-therapy. It is a way of creating a journal, a record of your life. It's a way of learning to appreciate the things around you. It has so many different uses and powers that are really different from what we think about when we think about quote-unquote art, you know, and we think of art hanging in museums, and we think about modern art. We think about a bunch of stuff that really is irrelevant to this experience that I'm talking about, an experience of just making stuff and enjoying your creative ability and discovering so many different things that you can draw and different ways that you can draw. It's interesting that you mentioned Andy Warhol. In fact, in the book, I think it's in about the middle of the book, I have a drawing that I did of a can of beans, actually. But I invite people to draw cans of beans, draw cans of soup, draw cans of peas, anything you want to, because there's really no limit to what we can turn into art. I think that's what Andy Warhol was saying when he drew that, when he painted the soup cans, was he was saying, why couldn't this be art? You know, we think of art as having to be about, you know, portraits and flowers and landscapes. But I've done lots of art of dogs. I've drawn shoes. I've drawn post offices. I've drawn old cars. You can draw anything. Have fun doing it and express yourself. There's just no limit.
You have done so many interesting things in this book. And you say, don't worry too much about supplies. Just use anything. Use sketchbooks or the cheapest paper you can find. Go to the dollar store, for heaven's sakes. And it's the idea of drawing. And you say paper, pen, time, and then, of course, the individual. And optional is talent, which I delighted in when I saw that. And when you feel like you are especially, you know, sophisticated, that you want to get a sketchbook, great. But you have to begin. And sometimes you don't even need to draw a straight line, do you?
You don't. In fact, if you want to draw a straight line, go and get a ruler.
I agree.
That's what they're there for. You don't really need any skill or ability to do that. You just need to slow down, and you can draw a straight line. That's not a terribly useful thing, and it's certainly not essential to learning to draw well. But, yeah, go and buy yourself a sketchbook. You don't have to wait till you're good at it. You can buy a sketchbook for the price of a sandwich. It's not a big investment. But what I like about drawing in a sketchbook is it's your own private little space. You draw in a sketchbook. You turn the page, you do another drawing, you do another drawing. You can also write little notes to yourself in your sketchbook. You can write about how you're feeling about what you're drawing. You can write about what happened to you that led you to draw this particular thing. You can write about memories that are coming up. And your sketchbook becomes a diary, a record of your day, of your life, of your experience. And you'll fill up that sketchbook page after page, and you don't have to show it to anybody. It's not like hanging a picture on the wall. It can be your own private little place. And it also shows you over time how things are changing, how you're progressing. And I promise you that if you start a sketchbook, by the time you finish it, you'll be in a very different place. You'll feel very different about your abilities. You'll feel differently about the world. You'll see it more beautifully. You know, and it doesn't have to be anything complicated, as you say. It can be a simple sketchbook. It could be an exercise book, a composition book. And you can use any kind of pen. There's nothing magic about it. And all pens will work fine, a ballpoint pen. Or if you're looking for magic, then use a magic marker. That's what's magical about them. And you'll do some magical drawings.
You talk about tracing. And my goodness, there's been many times I remember as a child using tracing paper, which is so very, very thin. But you made another comment that I was surprised with. You said, turn an iPad into a light box. Explain that.
Well, an iPad, you know, most of us have iPads or we have a phone. So an iPad is basically a sheet of glass with light behind it. So you can turn on the little flashlight, or you can just leave the screen on. And then if you take a page from a magazine or a newspaper or a photograph, and you put it on your light box, and then you put a piece of paper in your sketchbook, a page of your sketchbook over it, it'll become like tracing paper. You'll be able to see right through it, and then you can trace. And what I like about tracing is you can use tracing as a way of overcoming your initial inhibition, your reservations about drawing. And you can say, well, I don't even know where to start. So fine, start by tracing. Trace an outline of the face, trace the shape of the head, and then turn off your iPad. Take off your, you know, take away the thing that you were tracing and use your imagination, or just use your eyes to take it to the next step, you know, or start doing a tracing of something that you see in a magazine, and then start using your imagination to make it more fanciful. You know, draw a person and then give them a mustache, and then give them some wings, and then give them, antenna, whatever it is you want to do. It just allows you to play and to have fun and to just get used to this idea that you can do this. It doesn't have a purpose until it starts to click in your brain. So don't worry about, well, why am I doing this, or what is this drawing for? Just think of it as a fun experience. But I promise you that if you allow yourself to do that, you'll start to feel confidence. And when you feel confidence, you'll start to say, you know what? I was able to trace that. It was like training wheels. But now let me try and draw something simple without tracing, and let me just draw it freehand and see how that goes. And the book takes you through a lot of these kinds of little ideas and concepts that allow you step by step to make progress on your own and to feel less awkward, less self-conscious, and more talented, if you will, over time.
Contours, layering with art for your background. Let's say you wanted to draw what was going on in your backyard. It's a way of training your brain to look at things differently, isn't it, when you're doing art?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a contour drawing, contour is the French word for outline. So what a contour drawing is, basically, is you're drawing the outlines of an object you're looking at. So you're not getting all preoccupied with shading and lighting and perspective and all those things. You're just drawing the shapes that make up the object. And what you'll find is if you do that, if you break any object in the world can be broken down into shapes, no matter how complicated it is. It's really just a bunch of different shapes and lines. And if you break it down, like doing a crossword puzzle, you just break it down into one thing, and then you draw the thing next to it, and then you draw the thing above it, and the thing below it. You just draw each little individual shape, each little individual contour, and soon you'll have drawn the most complicated thing. Just think of it as shapes that sit next to each other. And if you start with one shape and then move to the next, before long, you will have captured the image of what it is you're looking at. So contour drawing is extremely valuable. It's the basic building block of most forms of drawing and art.
You have so many expressions of the artistic side, which, for example, a milk carton. I think one of the most difficult things for people to realize is that we're surrounded with art. Advertising employs art. I remember taking my granddaughter to a school, an art institute in Seattle. And after we'd done a tour, because she was very talented as an artist, and after we'd done the tour, I asked her what she saw when we started driving down one of the streets of Seattle. And she looked at me with questions in her eyes. I said, "All right, what do you see as art?" And we would go by stores. I said, "What did you see in that store?" And she'd describe it. I said, "All right, that's art. That's an artistic display. What about the billboards? What about tags on anything? The street signs?" And before you know it, we're engaged in this observation experience. That had never happened to her before.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that when you start to draw, you start to see. And you start to observe things that you'd never noticed before. I mean, as I said, when I started to draw, it really opened my eyes to the beauty all around me. I used to walk to work every day, and when I would walk through the different neighborhoods, you know, I was in a blur. You know, nowadays I'm sure I would have had my headphones on listening to a podcast or listening to a wonderful radio show like yours, and I would have just been in my head, you know, not noticing what was going on around me. But when I started to draw, I started to notice the shapes of the roof, the ornamentation around the roof of a building. I would notice the shapes of the letters on a sign, the shapes of the shadows. I would notice how pigeons sat on a phone line. I would notice little things like, you know, the shape of a garbage can or what the tire of a car looked like from a certain angle. Suddenly I was really present in the moment. I was seeing so much more clearly what was going on around me. And I was noticing all kinds of beauty, all kinds of interesting phenomena that I'd never paid attention to before. So even when I wasn't drawing, the act of drawing really changed my experience of the world around me. And I think that a lot of artists have that, just much more of a sensitivity and an awareness of what's going on around them, of the shapes of people's faces, or the things that they're doing, the things that they're wearing, the way that they walk, the way that they sit. There's just so many things that are going on around us. And now, increasingly, we spend so much time buried in our cell phones. you know, looking at social media. And when you start to draw, you realize that we have all these little moments in our day that we can fill with art making. We can fill with contemplation. We can fill with creation rather than just absorbing other people's ideas and creations through, you know, social media. So I think the drawing allows you to never be bored again, never need to escape from reality, but instead appreciate how rich and beautiful the world is around us.
I agree. I also feel that just like with writing, writing is a form of artistry and artistic expression in its way. Maybe people don't feel that, but I do. And I think art is the same way. Music, too. And in your book, you mention combining music along with doing the artwork. How would that be combined, and what would you recommend someone do? This, of course, you've got the exercise in your book, but I'd like you to share it.
Absolutely. Now, this is something, maybe you did this when you were a kid and you'd forgotten about it, but it's a really fun experience. So a key part of drawing and making art is the quality of your line. Different kinds of lines can express different kinds of feelings. And if you think about it, a rough, jagged line might express one kind of feeling, whereas a smooth, fluid, thick line might mean something different. A thin, scratchy line might express one thing, and a dotted, broken-up line might express something else. So the exercise that I suggest is put on a piece of music and put on some headphones and pick up a pen and let the pen sit on your on a page in your sketchbook or on a piece of paper and just let your hands start moving with the music and see what kinds of lines your body is making in response to the music. Listen intently to the music and let your hand move. Now switch to a totally different kind of music and do the same exercise. You might also switch to a different kind of pen. Maybe you're using a little thin pen. Now maybe you want to switch to a big fat magic marker or a crayon and try the same thing. Just let your hand move along and see how it reacts to the music. Just try and draw a line that feels like the song. So you might try a piece of classical music, and then you might try a piece of jazz, and then you might try a piece of pop music, and just see how you're interpreting those different lines. So what you're doing with this line that you're making is you're expressing a feeling. And that's at the core of art. It's more important than we think so much that what artists are able to do is that they're able to capture reality. They're able to make drawings that look like photographs, and that's an incredible talent and skill. And yes, that is one of the abilities that artists have. But that's not that interesting compared to the ability that an artist has to express emotion and feeling. Because that's what we get out of great art, is we look at something and we share that feeling and emotion that the artist had in their drawing or painting. So they look at a subject, they do a portrait of somebody, and they express it with a certain quality of line that tells you something way beyond words, something that expresses itself in this nonverbal way. So their feeling goes into the line, and then when we look at the line through our eyes, we pick up that feeling again. That's what music does. But this exercise that you can do with a line, you can have that same exact experience of your body translating what your ears are hearing and that feeling coming out of your hand. And then you can just switch it, and you'll see that as the feeling of a different kind of music, a different tempo, a different emotion comes through you, your line quality will change too. And then you can take that experience and you can start to try and do some drawings with it. So you could draw a simple face with one quality of line, and then you could draw a similar kind of face with a different quality of line, and those two faces will be expressing very different feelings and emotions, and that's just really interesting to see.
The thumb and a pen. You say keeping things in proportion, and I think that that is an aspect that many people get very overwhelmed with. How in the world is our thumb going to make a difference with what we draw?
Well, you know, I think we've all seen that in movies. You always see the the artist holding up their thumb and squinching down one eye like Popeye and kind of aiming it at their model or the landscape and then somehow drawing something and it looks accurate. And you go, well, what did that have to do with this? Well, your thumb is a ruler. You can use your thumb. You could use your pen. And what you do is you hold it up and you measure your thumb, let's say, relative to the height of the object that you're drawing. So say you're drawing a tree. You hold up your thumb. You lock your elbow against your ribs. You hold your arm stiff. You close that eye and you go, okay, I'm going to put the base of my thumb at the bottom of the tree and I'm going to put the top of the tree is going to line up with the top of my thumb. And I go, okay, that tree now looks like it's one thumb high. Now I'm going to turn my thumb and I'm going to measure how wide is that tree relative to my thumb. And so what you can do is you can use your thumb to just give you a few points of reference. So you're basically making little marks on your paper to tell you, okay, this tree is about that size. Because a lot of times we think that things are different heights or widths than they actually are. Like we might, for instance, say, like, how high is a car compared to the length of a car? Well, if you measure it with your thumb, you might be surprised that a car is actually way longer than you thought, or perhaps way shorter. But using your thumb as a way of giving yourself a point of reference, a little measuring stick that gives you a place to begin. You don't have to do hundreds of measurements. You just need to do some basic ones. And then when you do your drawing, it will be so much more satisfying because it feels in proportion. It feels right. And you go, okay, I've got those basic pieces down. Now I can go in, as I said before, and fill in more and more details, and it will be more and more accurate.
You talk about how to hold a pen for sketching. You've got all kinds of information there for drawing, a different way of holding the pen being in control by your fingers. And I really appreciated your section. Of course, I had brought up Picasso shortly after we started talking and how I felt some of the artwork because I saw an exhibit with much of his work and the various things that he had done, which were just absolutely phenomenal. And then I looked at the kindergarten style stuff that he was coming out with. But you make a point, and that was that he had left 50,000 items behind, and that's almost incomprehensible. But he was always drawing, wasn't he? I mean, he was always doing something.
Yeah, I mean, Picasso lived a really long time, and he made an awful lot of art. And what you have to remember about Picasso is that he was a prodigy. When he was a teenager, he could draw anything, and it looked like a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And his problem was that when he got to a certain point and he could draw like a photograph, he lost interest. You know, he was able to do this thing so easily, but then he started to say to himself, "Well, the point of art isn't just to make photographs. The point of a camera is to make photographs. So if I want to express myself as an artist, how do I push to the next level? How do I express the feelings? How do I express ideas? Because just drawing completely accurately isn't going to be enough." So that's how he ended up creating cubism and creating abstract art, because he wanted to push beyond just realism to capturing emotions and feelings and the way that we see. But the interesting thing to me about Picasso is, and this is something that I think a lot of us run into, is we sit down and we make a few drawings and none of them are very good because we're just starting out. And we say to ourselves, you see, I did two or three drawings. None of them were any good. I clearly have no talent. I should just give up. And I referenced the number of drawings that Picasso made to remind you that Picasso is famous for a dozen pieces of art, maybe, probably more than most artists, but there's really only a small number of pieces of art that he's famous for. But he made so many, many, many more, because not everything that Picasso did was perfect, and Picasso was the greatest artist of the 20th century. So even he made a lot of pieces of art that weren't great. So chances are that the fact that you've made two or three not great pieces of art is not an indication that you won't make something good. But even if it doesn't, you know, Picasso made art all the time because he loved it. He made art out of cardboard. He made art out of found objects. He did sculptures. He made ceramics. He wove rugs. He wrote poetry. He just expressed himself in lots of different ways. Some of the art was amazing and changed the history of the world, and some of it was just for him and for fun. You know, so you can be like Picasso in lots of different ways if you want to. And to me, he's just a great example of amazing creativity and also the willingness to take risks, make mistakes, and not be crushed by them, but just keep going.
Danny, your book, How to Draw Without Talent, is, I think, marvelous. And you know what? I think it'd be a great family project for the family, maybe to sit for a couple of hours and to do some of the exercises you have here. What fun, what conversation it would elicit. And without, you know, without any criticism, just to do it for the fun of it and have maybe pizza afterwards or ice cream or whatever's your thing for the family get together. I just think it's teachers could use this, and there's just so many ways that it could be utilized by different people in different environments. I think it's a great communication tool as well. Danny Gregory, you have two websites. You have DannyGregory.com, and Danny is D-A-N-N-Y, and I say that because there's a lot of ways of spelling Danny. D-A-N-N-Y, Gregory, G-R-E-G-O-R-Y.com. Also, Sketchbook School. And school is spelled S-K-O-O-L. Yes, Danny is very artistic and original in more than one way. More than one way. Sketchbookschool.com. Danny, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you so much, and thanks so much for asking me so many great questions. It was really fun to talk to you, and thanks for sharing my book with the world. And if you want to know anything more about me or what I do, come to sketchbookschool.com. This book is actually based on a course that I made, which you can take at sketchbookschool.com, that over 10,000 people have already taken, and you can join them. And in a weekend, you can pick up a lot of the basic things you need to draw and to have fun making art, and I hope you'll join me there.
Danny Gregory, thanks ever so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a nice night.
Thank you. Donna Sebo here, and we are going to be taking a break. DannyGregory.com, Sketchbook School, S-K-O-O-L.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you'd like to have an opportunity to be featured on this program or Warriors for Peace heard Wednesdays, please send a copy of your publication along with your contact information to The Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review of the publication. Again, the mailing address is Post Office Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497.
Live a happy life. Turn your average life into a happy life with Paula Vale's book, Why Am I So Happy? Tired of waking up to the same routine, but just a different day? Would you like to live a happy life effortlessly? We want to introduce you to Paula Vale, the author of Why Am I So Happy? Paula is a TV/radio host, Reiki master/teacher, and published author. She understands life's challenges and will guide you in releasing negative thoughts to find emotional and physical joy and balance. Paula shares tips on how to invest in yourself to become the joy-filled person you were meant to be. Paula's book, Why Am I So Happy?, is informative, inspiring, and overflowing with gratitude. Her words benefit both men and women and provide a guide to living a happy, healthy, fun, and prosperous life. Why live the happy life? Because you deserve it. It's that simple. Don't procrastinate, because you could be living your happy life now. Purchase Paula's book, Why Am I So Happy?, on Amazon.com today.
Donna Sebo, 253-582-5597 is the telephone number to call into if you would like to chat with me. I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Also, just know we've got a great lineup of guests. We're going to be talking tomorrow with Richard Smoley, The Theology of Love. We were to have Richard on, it was back in December, but his phone line went down. And, you know, during winter months, strange things can happen with telephone lines. So anyway, he's back with us now, and we are going to be chatting with him tomorrow. And if you'd like to be kept informed about who's coming up on the show, well, it's real simple. You can either sign up for the monthly newsletter where all of my guests are featured, and then you can also like us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and we are more than happy to keep you informed. My Deb, my assistant, she does that very nicely. She sends out an image of the cover of the publication we're going to be discussing, and also a little bit of a write-up that we put together so you know a little bit about what's coming up, coming on the Donna Sebo Show. Now, remember, Wednesdays are a doubleheader, and we have Warriors for Peace. And our guest coming up is going to be talking about the terriers in India. No, I'm not talking about dogs. I am talking about a group of men, British civilians, who fought in India. The history of what different countries have done, I think, is amazing. And these were men that were willing to go to whatever was necessary in environment and stand up for what they believed in. It's really quite a fascinating conversation. It's a history I had absolutely no knowledge about. And the truth is, most people don't have the knowledge. So that is what is going to be coming up on Warriors for Peace. And this, I think, is something that's very important. Also, we have got another, well, let's see. No, that one has already passed. So I'm just going to leave that one as it is because we are going to be moving right along. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 253-582-5597. I wanted to share a story with you that I came across in my library, and it intrigued me so much because when it was written so many years ago, it was titled by the author, who was Fred Dickinson, it was titled The Man Who Stole God. Now, that title would grab just about anybody's attention, and it is about a young man, and this was a number of years ago, in New York City. He was in a rooming house. He was a redhead. His name, they gave him the name of Jim. He had a dresser drawer in the room that he was using that had a chisel in it. He took it with him, and he's out walking with the thousands of other people that are always walking on the streets of New York. New York City. Well, he stops at a particular street, goes into another direction, and he's looking into cars that are parked along the curb. Nobody was paying attention to him. He had learned to develop the street smarts of a thief, if you will. He was checking everything that was going on, and he noticed a car that was going into a space that wasn't too far away from where he was doing his observations. The driver gets out of the vehicle, locks the doors, and watched him very carefully. Now, this man had dark hair that was sort of long, thin black mustache. This kid, Jim, he looked at him and he thought, he looks like he's got a lot of money. So, one of the things that the owner of the vehicle had not paid attention to is that he left part of his window open on one side of the car. Now, this is going back a few years because the window that was left open was like a wing window. Your cars in your 50s often had those little wing windows that you could get into. So, here's this thief standing and watching. He takes out the chisel. He manages to open up the window, pops open very easily. He's able to get to the door lock. He sees two suitcases in the car. He takes them out and walks away. Well, what was happening while all of this thievery was going on is there was a man by the name of Alfonso de Ortega. He was very, very well known as a composer and a conductor. He was often at Carnegie Hall, did a lot of national radio shows. His compositions were extraordinarily popular. Now, he was supposed to be conducting the Buffalo Symphony Orchestra in Buffalo, New York, in a Pops concert, and he was working very, very diligently on his arrangements and the scores, and the very next day, he was supposed to drive to Buffalo for one of the rehearsals for this big event that was going on in that community. Well, he took care of whatever he was taking care of at this hall that he had gone into, and he goes to his car. Yes, and he finds that it's been broken into. His suitcases are stolen. But what stressed him out more than anything else, he said, the clothes, who cares about the clothes? It's my music. All of his composing, everything was in that suitcase. They didn't have cell phones, obviously, at that time. So he naturally calls the police. He said, you've got to find my music. I have this huge performance. He tells them what was in the suitcase. He said, I don't care about the clothes. I don't care about any of the stuff in there. All I care about is my music. So the detective, who's obviously not a musician, says, well, what kind of music do you have in there? He says, I have my orchestrations. I have my special arrangements. I have all of my religious compositions. And the detective looked at him. He said, religious? He said, one's a hymn, and it's titled Everyone Must Have a Friend. And he said, the other is music that I wrote for Ave Maria. Well, this is what happened. De Ortega ended up driving to a church that was nearby. It's the Church of St. Francis of Assisi on West 31st Street. Now, he was a lay member of the Third Order of St. Francis, and he had been deeply involved with the church for years. So he ends up going through the church and goes to the shrine of St. Anthony. He was so distressed that he was in there for well over 2 hours. He was praying. He just was praying that the saint would help him with his problems. Well, the thief, he was back in his rooming, and in the rooming facility, and in his room, he, of course, was emptying out the suitcases. What could he fence? Well, the clothes were really, really nice clothes, so he knew he was going to get a good amount of cash for that. And he said, what about this music? It's a bunch of junk. And he picked him up and he throws him down and he unpacked, you know, everything he could. And then he took it to a pawnbroker that worked as a fence and he was able to, you know, get money for it. Well, he left the pawnbroker. He had 7 pawn tickets in his pocket as well as $140. Now, in that time, that was quite a bit of money for him. Then he goes back to the room. Here's all these papers with music. He stuffs the music into these paper bags that he has. They're 2 grocery bags. And he said, I'm just stuffing them in. And he notices a piece of music with the title Ave Maria. Now, he held that sheet of music, and he called when he was a kid. He was from Chicago originally. He used to sing in school. And he could hear the music of Ave Maria, because in his school, the children sang it at Christmas. And he read these words, everyone must have a friend, after he picked up another sheet of music. Everyone must have a friend to tell his troubles too, and I found mine, oh dearest Lord, my truest friend is you. And then he sees another piece of paper, and there is the name of Alfonso de Ortega, the conductor, the man he had robbed. And he put the hymn down, the friendship hymn and Ave Maria, put that into a drawer, and then stuffed the rest of the music into these paper bags and took them somewhere out in the night. He was back in about a half an hour, and he couldn't go to sleep. He was thinking and he was remembering. Now, the very next day was Sunday. Remember, the conductor was supposed to be in Buffalo. Well, there was a woman by the name of Mrs. Brain. She was the widow of a pianist and a composer. She left her apartment on a particular street in New York, and she was stopped on her way out by the manager of the apartment, who was a woman, and she said, "Mrs. Bain, look at this. Somebody threw all of this music out." And the manager was holding up the music, and she knew that the widow of the composer and the pianist had a son who was also a pianist. She said, "Maybe your son could use this music." Mrs. Brain, she said, "Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much." But she really didn't have an opportunity to look at the music. She didn't pay any attention to the two bags. So she's on her way in to her destination when she tunes on the radio. Now, this was at 11 a.m. Sunday morning. And there's a particular station in New York that plays really good music. And they're broadcasting this robbery of De Ortega's items. Well, Mrs. Brain goes to the bags. Her son happened to come in. He was going to join his mother on Sunday. And they were looking through it. And her son, because he's a professional musician, noticed certain things. And he said, "Mom, this is De Ortega's work. Look, this is his best piece. Look at this information." Well, this is something that when they found this, they said, "Okay, we have got to get this to them." So this is what happens 2 weeks later. So the music is returned that they found to De Ortega. A few weeks later, De Ortega receives a letter containing 7 pawn tickets. And this is what the letter said. "I'm so sorry about breaking into your car and putting you to all this trouble. But with the bad sometimes comes good. And in my case, it is that I quit this kind of business that night. I now have a job and live as I should." Yes, it was the young thief. He said, "Because of Ave Maria and the song Everyone Must Have a Friend, I started going back to church. And he said, when I get nerve enough, maybe I'll go to confession. I'm so glad all of this happened because I really feel different now and I'm trusting you have forgiven me." Well, De Ortega took the 7 pawn tickets to the pawn shop, got his clothes back, and told the police, "You don't need to search anymore." Now, he thought that was the end of it. He got his music back. He got his clothes back. He got this wonderful letter from the thief. But that wasn't the end of the story. 3 years later, he conducted an SOS at Carnegie Hall. And the Brain's widow and the son was present. But he was unaware that there was a young man in the audience that was listening very attentively. He was unaware also that this same young person would attend every concert of his that he possibly could. There was an usher on one occasion, and it was May 57 of this particular year, that said, "There's a young man I want you to meet. You'll see him over there at St. Anthony's Shrine. He says he wants to speak to you." So, Mr. De Ortega, he goes and he joins a young man. He kneels at the prayer section in front of the saint statue. And the young man said, "There's something I have to tell you. Can we go somewhere for a cup of coffee?" Well, the young man, Jim, yes, you guessed it, he wanted to talk to De Ortega. He counted out $140 and gave it to the musician. He said, "I'm sorry this took so long, but I had to save it up before I spoke to you. I finally broke down and went to confession." He said, "Your suitcases were the last things I ever stole. I'm ready now for my punishment. You can call the police." De Ortega said, "Nah, I'm not going to call the police. Come on, let's go back again to St. Anthony." Do you know, this young man kept in touch with De Ortega for years. And the story ends up with the fact that the Ortega ended up finding out about the young man when he got married, when his children were born, and what it was. He found God, as de Ortega would say, in a stolen suitcase. I wanted to share that with you because so many times we have situations that occur in our lives and the synchronicities that go along. It's so often so fascinating to me how one situation will lead to another situation that brings you in touch with certain people that you never would have ever had an opportunity to meet. And it all sort of goes together. Really is very, very intriguing. And I know there's some of you out there who are going to say, Donna, that can happen in a negative way. True. That's true. That's very true. But here you had a situation where a young person was impressed with a sheet of music. You know, my guest that we were talking with talked about, we're talking about art and drawing. Sometimes there has to be that special something that touches your heart and your mind in a way that makes you realize you have a choice. And that's what happened with the young man, Jim. He realized that he did have a choice. He didn't have to be a thief. And it was words to music that he read that reminded him perhaps of some good times that he had had. And when he, whatever it was, it made him decide to become a thief, maybe it was hunger, who knows? But he opted out of it. And I think that it's so important for us to realize that if we have something we don't like, if we have an environment that we're in that we don't like, if we are feeling like we don't have talent, why not choose a different direction and see what else might come out of it? You just don't know where you're going to go, who you're going to meet, what is going to evolve. You just don't know. But often it takes a commitment, a dedication, a belief that's so strong, and you realize you can't control everything. De Ortega had to make adjustments for his performances. All of his stuff was stolen from him. Now he did what he needed to do. He called the police. They didn't find anything. But don't you think it's interesting that the young man ended up going someplace and leaving two bags of music that just happened to be, and he doesn't know these people, in an area of New York, he just left it there. And that a landlady walks out, says, I've got these people that have got an apartment. I need to let them know about this because they're big into music. She didn't know what she was looking at. She just knew it was a lot of music. Maybe the son could use it, who's a professional pianist. What are the odds? I love stories like that. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 253-582-5597. Now, I want to bring up, I'm doing a seminar on February the 15th. This is an all-day seminar. I am giving a total commitment of time to you for a full day, from 9 until 5. This is Dynamics of the Mind 2. I want to empower you to understand how your mind can work in some phenomenal ways and how it can benefit you in your life in ways that are unexpected. And this is very interactive. We have exercises we do. We're also going to have a wonderful keynote speaker, Kimberly Clark Sharp, and she is just absolutely fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. A wonderful woman, a number of near-death experiences. She's written a book called After the Light. She has interviewed people. She's been doing research on people that have had near-death experiences for years. And she started the IANS group, the International Association for Near-Death Experiences, and it's international now. She started it 44 years ago. And the stories and the people that she brings to the public are just, it's just absolutely great. So anyway, check it out. go to my website. If you want to join me in my class, it's going to be at a banquet room in Fife, Washington at the Poodle Dog restaurant. They have these very nice banquet rooms. Come on up, join us. And if you register before the 7th of February, you get a $50 discount. The seminar for the day is $250 a person. Lunch is included. And also, you need to know that you'll get that $50 discount if you register again. I'm repeating myself, prior to February the 7th. And again, the event is on the 15th, which is a Saturday. Okay, I wanted to share some superstitions about, you know, about clothing, about different items. Maybe you could call it, there's an old-fashioned word called finery, which could mean jewelry or anything. Well, if in China, I don't know what part of China this would pertain to, they feel if a necklace breaks, there's a member of the family who is sick, who's going to die. Don't you just love these positive things? And then when you give someone a purse as a gift, put a little money inside that purse. Because in Russia, they feel if you give someone a purse and you don't put money in it, and again, I don't know what part of Russia this, the former Soviet Union, I have no idea what where this is, that this originated. But they feel if you give a purse empty, it causes bad financial luck. Also, if you put a piece of snakeskin into your wallet, you're going to become rich or find money. This is something that originated in Japan. Another one is if you get your shirt wet while doing dishes, it means you're going to marry a drunk. That came out of Ireland. That had to have been someone that had done so many dishes and she was always wet and she was married to a drunk. It had to come from someone like that. Also, a pregnant lady should never wear a lei or the umbilical cord might choke her baby. Now, that came from Hawaii. Makes you wonder who came up with that and why. And also, there is something, and believe me, I had someone tell me this, my goodness, a number of years ago. I was at a public event, and my hands were occupied, and I put my purse on the floor, and the person that was in front of me said, "Don't do that. No, don't do that. That's bad luck." I had no idea that putting your handbag on the floor, if you do that in Poland, this is where it originated from, the money that you have inside your purse will disappear. Now, this person who was from another culture, not from Poland, but from, I think, South America, if I remember correctly, she was adamant, you never put your purse down on the floor. Well, in some respects, it might keep somebody from, you know, picking the purse of your valuables. However, she said, no, it's bad luck. You never put it down on the floor. Well, again, if you're going to get robbed, if you put it down on the floor, it's probably going to get stolen. So that's just a little bit of trivia that I thought I would share with you. The one of getting the shirt wet while doing dishes. Oh, boy, that is a doozy. But you never know. Sometimes these superstitions, if you will, or these belief systems start off with some kind of logic to them, and then for some reason, as they go along, they get embellished with the wrong kind of stuff, and then you wonder, is this really valid? Well, it may or may not be. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 253-582-5597. One of the biggest challenges that we have when it comes to food is preserving food. And for any of us that have been cooking for a while or been engaged in various ways of making sure that food lasts, I think my grandmother was the one that introduced me to canning. And I really didn't start doing any canning until I was in my 30s. And the reason was it just didn't appeal to me, and that was the last thing I wanted to spend my time on. But as I really got into cooking and doing different things, and then, of course, when you have a family and you get intrigued, there's different phases in your life where you're intrigued by different things. It's wonderful. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You're captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We're going to be back tomorrow. Bye for now. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.